Author of more than a dozen books on child and adolescent developments, most recently one titled The Handbook of Spiritual Development in Childhood and Adolescence, and also a book that actually sometime soon is due out in a new edition, which is titled All Kids Are Our Kids, published by Jossie Bass. And the subtitle is What Communities Must Do to Raise Caring and Responsible Children and Adolescents. And it takes a look at what it is we know about healthy child development, those things that are within the child and those things that are within the community, and things that then we can do as a community to do everything that we can to make sure that kids do grow up to be healthy and happy. He is here visiting the campus. His sponsor for the visit is the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program, which is part of the Department of Human and Community Development within the College of ACES. That's Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Science. And we're pleased that they made it possible for us to talk with him this morning. Questions, comments, too, are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana. The number, 333-9455. We do also have toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, well, you're welcome to call with questions, comments. The only thing we ask of people is to just try to be brief so we keep things moving along. Well, thanks very much for being here.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you for asking me.
I had a chance to take a look at the book, this particular book, and which is just one of the things that you have done. And I know you, just before we got going, you said you're actually working on a new and updated version of the book. This was published first in 1997.
Right.
And I was really struck by something that you write here, kind of in as a way of preface to the book, where you write that the measure of the health of a society is how well it takes care of its youngest generation. And by this standard, we fail. 97. Are we doing any better in 2005?
No, I don't think so. In fact, I think in the last 10 years, we may have lost some ground in the national investment in positive development. Some of that has to do, I think, with national economic priorities that move in some other directions. But I also think it may be more difficult to grow and raise healthy kids 10 years after almost 10 years after 1997, too. I think as societies get more complex, as they change more rapidly, as innovations occur, the need to pay attention to the development of kids and to pay attention on a daily basis, I think that need increases each decade as this society matures. And so if we don't invest in new ways, not only financially, but just in terms of relationships and connection, it's getting too common to miss that mark on being a nation that really puts young people at the center of national life.
It really, it strikes me that there's an important idea here embedded in the title, and that is that while parents, I think, most parents, they want what's best for their children, and they're willing to advocate for it and to fight for it to the extent that they have the ability and the knowledge to do that. So people want the best for their own children, but we don't often extend that level of energy to everybody else's children. And it seems that that's an important idea. We give a lot of lip service to the idea of family in this country, and our families are important to us.
That's right.
But other people's families, they don't always rise to the same level of importance.
No, that's right. There's probably a sociology of this that's beyond my expertise, but in the way in which societies are organized, there are many that are more communal in nature, so that people who are unrelated to kids still feel responsible and accountable. Sometimes that's about extended family, but sometimes it's about the entire village having a very natural sense that all of us are in this together. I think in societies that move to the individualism side, start to create very protective cocoons around kids called family, and then we count on family to be the agent of socialization, and all by themselves, and then they have to broker to school and broker to other organizations within towns and cities. I think in some sense that process interferes with being sure that all kids receive on a daily basis evidence from community people that they matter, that they're valued, they're needed, they're wanted. And so it is important, I think, to begin to consider in this society, how do we move the needle from kids belong to only a couple people to the idea that really kids, in some sense, belong to all of us. We are all accountable, all responsible. And I think my most important work in all of this is that everybody has capacity to matter in the development of young people. But we've got to rethink what we mean by that capacity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's certainly no shortage of information on parenting.
Right.
You go into any bookstore and there will be an enormous section that have books on that subject. And popular media is full of stuff right. about it. And here on this program, we've talked about it a lot. And it's the kind of thing that's discussed plenty enough, with the focus being within mm-hmm. the family, what it is that mm-hmm. individual parents do with their mm-hmm. individual kids. But it seems that this other kind of focus, this much larger kind of focus that talks about community and what things communities can do as communities mm-hmm. to make their communities good places mm-hmm. for kids to grow up, doesn't seem to get as much attention.
No, it doesn't. That the community-wide approach of how we connect the dots, connect institutions and people to share a vision together about what kids need to succeed, that in some sense is the work we do at Search Institute, is trying to help towns and cities capture that sense of shared vision and that sense of being community around all kids. That is too much of a missing piece in the literature or in the bookstores you're talking about. I'll tell you another piece that's missing. This country acts like development ends at about age 8 or 9, and so so much of the parenting information is about how do you grow healthy kids when they're infants and toddlers and grade school ages. Then you start to look about middle school and high school. And if there's any literature at all, it's about kids as demonic, right? It's yeah. about kids as scary, yeah. kids as aliens. And we act in this country like in the second decade, good luck. So you look at magazines on newsstands, they give really good parenting advice up to about age 10. And then there is a vacuum in this nation about the strategy and tactic of growing healthy adolescents after age 10. So one of my crazier dreams in life is to figure out how to do a newsstand quality magazine on the parenting of teenagers and the growth of strong, successful teenagers. It wouldn't be about violence, drugs, rock and roll, but about how do you grow caring young people? How do you grow generous young people? How do you grow young people who affirm diversity? How do you grow kids to become leaders? And I think it's a terribly crucial symptom in this nation that of the malaise we're talking about is the way we look at teenagers and the language that we use to describe teenagers tends to be dark and rarely on the side of how do we begin to think of teenagers as resources in our communities to be built on and to be utilized.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Peter Benson. He is president and the CEO of the Search Institute. It is a nonprofit organization based in Minneapolis where they do research on child development and also advocate for those things that make healthy communities for kids. He's authored a number of books. He's here visiting the campus. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. In this, the book that I mentioned, one of these books that you've written, the All Kids Are Our Kids, you come up with a long list of individual items that you think contribute to healthy mm-hmm. child development. And some of these things have to do with the environment outside the child. Mm-hmm. particularly the things about that have to do with parents and how they relate to their kids and what kind of community it is and their involvement with the importance of their involvement with adults other than simply their parents. It's about 20 things are in that category. And then there are another 20 things that have to do with what's going on inside the child. And I'm sure your argument would be that the more of these things that you can provide, the more of these things that are there, the better off that kids are going to be. Without going through all 40 points, what's the general idea of this approach?
The general idea of the approach is it started with, could you scientifically name a series of building blocks of daily experience that matter for all kids in the United States, that matter really universally for successful development? So across race, ethnicity, family income, small towns, big towns, what does science tell us about those developmental experiences that help grow healthy kids? We developed this taxonomy of 40 of these. As you note, 20 of those we call ecological assets. They need to occur in young people's environments, within their families, schools, neighborhoods, youth programs. And the other 20 are those internal assets, which are about the competencies and skills and perspectives that one needs to have to become a successful adult in America. But here's a couple quick points. We have created also an assessment instrument so that towns and cities can look at the development of their young people through the lens of these 40 building blocks, these developmental nutrients, and to hear young people describe their lives in terms of to what degree do our neighborhoods places that know kids? To what degree do young people have intergenerational relationships that last longer than a year, which is another great and important building block. To what extent are kids engaged in art, music, drama, and the expressive side of life, another great developmental asset. We've now done this assessment, this portrait making in 2,500 American cities, now also in a number in Canada. And about 3 million young people have been a part of this process. What we learn is that the average number of assets of the 40 in young people's lives is 19. When you combine that with the very powerful scientific fact that the more the better, the more of these developmental assets, the less risk behavior, like alcohol, tobacco, illicit drug use, violence, and the more assets, the more thriving, the more school success, the better young people affirm diversity, for example. We learn also that the developmental assets explain a lot more about outcomes than does a kid's race, ethnicity, family income, gender, or location. So these developmental building blocks are powerful, extraordinarily powerful, but they're in short supply now in America, which leads to the point, wow, could we begin to reimagine how the people of a city begin to come together in a new way to use the really natural capacity that communities have of being community, but we get busy, we get disconnected, we get siloed from each other. We over-depend on families alone, as we were talking about before. So the outcome of all of this is extraordinarily practical. That is, it is the question of the transformation of towns and cities to fall in love with their kids.
We have a caller. We had a caller. That person changed their mind. If they want to call right back, we can get them on. Other people who are listening, you're certainly welcome to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I was going to go on to ask, you talked just in a little bit in general terms about some of what these 40 points are, and that then also that you went out and you did an assessment of a number of communities around the country, and you found that on average, there are about half of them, 19 out of 40 were there. If you take a look then specifically at these various things, what I'm wondering is what would you say were the most significant deficits, those things that on this list that are most often not there?
Yeah, it's a great question. There are 6 of the 40 assets are about support, the way in which communities ought to deliver to young people that kind of affirmation that you matter. We're glad you're alive. You've got talent and skill. Can I help you? Can I be in your life? And some of those are very fragile developmental assets. I'll name a couple. One of the developmental assets is having 3 adults in your life, 3 or more, that you're unrelated to, who know you for longer than a year. And they check up on you. They inquire in your life. They send you birthday cards. They call you on the phone now and then or send you email messages. Just community adults who say, I think you're so important and interesting as a human being, I want to stay connected to you. We call that the asset of intergenerational community. The national number for that one is 41%. That is, of all the middle school and high school kids we have studied, and these now are hundreds of thousands of young people we study each year, only about 4 out of 10 have that developmental asset. And if you think about human development, if there's any magic in human development, it's about relationships, relationships, and relationships. So much about how we should transmit wisdom, transmit and nurture value. Much of this needs to happen in relationships of young people with elders in their life. So the point here is the United States is becoming an international leader in age segregation. With young people spending an extraordinary amount of time either alone now or with peers, and too little with caring and principled adults who are in their lives for longer than a few months. I mean, every kid has 6 adults who called teachers and coaches, but then the next semester or next year, it's a whole new team, and the continuity of relationship, I think, is critical to successful human development. Here's one other one that's fragile. It's the 7th asset. It's called Community Values Youth. It's the perception in young people's lives about the city in which they live. Is it a place that cares about kids or not? Only about 25% of America's middle school and high school students perceive that their town or city is a place that cares about kids. That is a very important developmental asset. On the negative side, it's a real deficit that so few kids have that sense that community is a place that values young people. I think one of the problems with not having that asset is it probably drives young people to peers as their source of value development and of competency building and of support. It's really the story of young people feeling like most adults in their town or city are really not on the team for growing healthy and successful kids.
Let's talk with someone in Chicago. Here's a caller on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I have a question regarding adults. Actually, adolescents, in this new economic demography where we see billions of dollars spent by industries, they're not particular to enforcing moral values, but that rather they target at the rebellious attitude that begins to morph at the adolescent age. How does this, does this have a big effect on teens?
That, and you are talking about the marketing of products to teenagers, some of which are not particularly useful for their positive development?
Yes.
Sure it does. I don't think American corporations tend to have much of a conscience about what's good and healthy for kids. You can look at the video market as one example of that and the extraordinary amount of violence that young people are exposed to, and the extraordinary amount of potentially dysfunctional sexuality that kids are exposed to. So there are some cases, sure, where the way in which we do marketing to young people is not advantageous for their successful development. I incidentally think that one of the important questions in America, if we're going to try to reorganize around supporting healthy development, is how do you bring in big business to be part of the team? Because the growing of healthy kids is, of course, about school districts and about neighborhoods and about families and about congregations, synagogue, and mosque. But it also ought to be about the way in which we do business and the way in which business needs to be with the rest of us community actors on the team for growing healthy kids.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. I want to go back for a moment to the point that you were discussing about this particular developmental asset that has to do with support. There's a cluster of them that have to do with support. And one of them that you were talking about was the importance for children and their development to have a supportive, positive relationship with some adults that are not their parents. And if you think about the adults that kids, school-age kids, are likely to be exposed to other than their parents, they will be their teachers, their coaches. Maybe they're involved in sports activities outside of school.
Right.
Or other sorts of things. That's still sort of teacher, sort of teacher coaches. Or if they're involved in, if their family is involved in the church, the synagogue, or the mosque, in a religious institution. Well, maybe there are people like that. What other possibilities are there actually? If you go outside of the church school structure, it doesn't strike me that there are many other likely adults to grab and sort of cast in this role.
Yeah, it's a good question. In fact, you know, back to the point about congregation, synagogue, and mosque, the potential of that social institution to surround kids with elders, if you will, for multiple years is extraordinary. But most faith communities don't take advantage of that intergenerational capacity, and they tend to wall off young people into age-segregated education and programming, when in fact the church ought to be the leader in kind of this reclaiming of intergenerational community. I think neighborhood is another potentially rich source of connectedness of family to family and multiple families to kids. One of the developmental assets, the fourth or fifth in the taxonomy, is about caring neighborhood. It is another developmental asset that only a minority of American kids now have. That is, through the lens, through the eyes of young people themselves, about 60% of kids say there is nobody in their neighborhood who knows who they are. Now, that tells us something about social change across the last 30 or 40 years. Neighborhoods, we're all working, we're all busy, we're all gone a lot. And it takes some work to reclaim neighborhoods as a network of families who know each other and where you get together enough so that you build some social trust and some invitation to neighbors to know each other's kids. So I think that's another terribly important source of relationship. Another thing we do a lot at Search Institute is begin to inquire about the adults who ought to be asset builders in kids' lives. How well are they really building assets? Like, take coaches, for example. So we do some significant training now for coaches in towns and cities about being an asset-building coach. That is, about knowing kids well, being present with them, knowing what their passion and joy is, knowing what their spark is. It isn't just about learning to run from first to second base. That ought to be secondary, but it becomes, for too many coaches, the only thing that matters is a particular athletic skill, or perhaps even worse, winning as opposed to losing. And so that the transformation of people in certain areas of volunteer work or of occupational work to really understand what it means to connect deeply to kids is a very important thing to do. Just one other quick story is about the adults called school bus drivers. Who would think about them as being on the team for All Kids Are Our Kids? But they are. And now in a number of cities, school districts are asking all school bus drivers to go through a day-long training in how to be an asset-building bus driver. That is, instead of sitting there like a bump on a log, being proactive in knowing kids, naming kids, using their names, looking them in the eye, treating them as though they matter. And these are some of the kind of magics of community really being connected to their kids.
We are about at the midpoint, a little bit past. We have a caller we'll get right to. Let me introduce again the guest, Peter Benson. He's president and CEO of Search Institute. It's a nonprofit that's based in Minneapolis that works to provide leadership, knowledge, resources to promote healthy children, youth, and communities. If you're interested in this particular kind of thing that we have been here talking about, this idea that there are these developmental assets and that the more that you have, the better off children will be, you might look at his book, All Kids Are Our Kids, published by Jossie Bass. Now, this was published in 1997, and sometime soon there will be an updated edition of the book. But you can go out and look at this one, and I'm sure that it gets some benefit out of it. He's here visiting the campus, his visit sponsored by the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program. If you're interested in finding out more about the Search Institute and you have internet access, they do have a website, which is www.search-institute.org. And in fact, if you're also interested in the Family Resiliency Program here at the U of I, they also have the website, which is www.familyresiliency.uiuc.edu. So you can find out what both of them are about. And questions welcome here, too. We have someone we'll get right to. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's caller in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hello. Yes. I'm calling, I'm a doctoral student in education, and I deal with music performance education. And I would like your guest's comment on the benefits of one-on-one interaction with kids in music studios, if he knows anything about it. Thank you.
Great question. And though I don't know a lot about music studios, I think I can attach your question to the stream of life that is about the engagement in music, art, drama, the expressive and creative side. Yes, indeed, in our taxonomy of the 40 assets, in the category of structured time use, there is a developmental asset about spending 3 hours a week or more in the performance and practice of art, music, drama, dance, and movement. So the fact that it's one of our 40 developmental assets means that there, in fact, is a scientific literature that documents that that developmental experience matters for young people's development. You should know here that it is the least common of the 40 assets in the United States, by far. Only, I think, about 15% of all middle school and high school students are now engaged in 3 hours a week or more in this important arena. And only about 8% of boys are engaged in 3 hours a week or more of this development of the creative and expressive life. This can be a very important catalytic developmental asset. One of the things that's really wonderful about the experience of art, music, and drama is it builds other assets. What that usually means is you're building a relationship with a couple talented adults when you're doing this work. People whose life is framed around the creative life. And so just being engaged in that time use might also generate a connection to a kind of intergenerational relationship that could have a presence in your life for a significant period of time. It also builds some developmental assets around a sense of personal competency and of personal success and of personal value. So it's an asset that, when it's present, spins out to inform some of the other developmental building blocks in the taxonomy. But I think one of the important questions is, what are we going to do in America to raise up this arena of the creative life and give it the center stage it deserves in the life of kids. It's been too easy in American town and cities to cut band, orchestra, drama when funding gets tight. And from my point of view, developmentally, that's been a very significant mistake.
Yeah, I think that there's an added advantage to taking lessons in, for example, violin or piano or these instruments. And that's the chance to interact one-on-one for half an hour or an hour a week with an adult that really cares about what you brought in.
Absolutely.
And I think that that's probably the chance, and, you know, that these things are usually long-term.
Absolutely.
And, you know, my mother teaches the piano, and she's had students that's been studying with her for 12 years. So here is the constant adult that you were talking
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely. That is a very powerful contribution to a young person's life.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that teachers need to become more aware of is that huge, huge educational opportunity that they have.
Yes.
To really impact who that person is going to become.
You know, that's a wonderful point, that when adults, particularly professional adults, are engaged with kids, it isn't just about the expertise that they're nurturing in the young. It's also about being present as a caring person in a young person's life. And so there is a lot of power in adult-child and adult-youth relationships. And I think you're right. It is a good thing to remind all people who work with kids, teachers, coaches, and others, of the ways in which they are present in a young person's life, and the depth of which they do that is very shaping for the long-term development of that young person.
Yeah, one of the teachers that piano teachers that I interviewed in the past said that asked, "What child gets an hour a week from an adult that's all about them, just all about them, no disturbances,
that's
nobody
right.
around, nothing else, just what they do."
That's right.
And most kids today don't even get that from their parents. So I think that's a huge opportunity, and I thank you for your comments.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. I have a couple of other people here I get to in a moment. I want to ask a question. It was one that actually came in off the air, and I think that it's a good one, and that it goes to, again, one of these other assets, and that is that young people perceive adults in the community value youth.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, well, what would be the signs in a community that indeed said that the community valued young people?
Yeah. One of my most powerful experiences talking about the developmental assets was in a town of 10,000 people in southwestern Minnesota. I don't have time to do this much anymore, but I used to love to go and bring the community portrait of the developmental assets to a town meeting. Sometimes in these towns, they will assemble 1,000, 2,000, or 3,000 citizens to hear what their young people are saying about the tone and tenor of community life. It's a powerful moment in the life of a city. So anyhow, at this one town of 10,000, I was to speak, but before I spoke, the young woman who was the president of the student council got up. And a 17-year-old young woman, I had no idea what she was going to say. She gets up, there's 1,000 people in the audience, and she says, I'm looking out at this crowd, and I can see my kindergarten teacher and my soccer coach when I was 8 years old, and my folks are here, and an aunt and an uncle. But I'm also here to look at you and testify why it is true that only 20% of us have the asset of community values youth. And then she looks at them and says, you are so proud of the money you're raising for that new daycare center and the money you have raised for new soccer fields, but you no longer make time or take time. You no longer make time or take time. There was a silence in that crowd that was unbelievable. What she was sensing was, and she was right on target, is that caring for youth is not demonstrated by the money we raise, the places that we build to make up for absent adults. And so she was letting that community have it about you're becoming an unrelational, a non-relational city that's programming us to death. And kids understand this. Kids in towns that have lots and lots of programs are among the first to say, this is a town that doesn't really care about kids, because they program at us all the time, but nobody ever slows down just to invite me to be with them and talk. Adults never ask us to join them in doing acts of generosity in our town or city. They treat us as objects of programs, not as subjects in community. So kids get the loss of relationship, and they are very good at seeing that there is no easy substitute that you can create for it.
Let's talk with some other folks. Urbana, next, line two.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. You're very interesting.
And, thank you.
thank you. I'm teaching right now at the university, and so I know you're talking about kids, and these are young adults, mm-hmm. but I've worked really hard to be a teacher that I feel like the students can relate to. And it's been incredibly valuable. I mean, they've really responded. But what I've noticed is it is actually quite a bit of work to care. And
yes.
And I think that part of the problem is, I mean, you're talking about the programming, and I see what you mean, because often the teaching is just for results, like you said,
mm-hmm.
Not to have a relationship. But when a teacher chooses to have a relationship, if the compensation is not enough,
mm-hmm.
the burnout level is so high.
Yes.
I mean, and I wonder if you could talk to that. I mean, the way that the society doesn't value the people who will bother to relate to their children.
Yeah.
And, okay, so I'm going to hang up. Thank you.
Those are wonderful ideas and questions about the power of being a relational teacher, an asset-building teacher, and the way in which that's kind of gotten lost in American education as we as the demands to teach to tests have increased so highly. You know, I occasionally get to talk to large numbers of public school teachers. Did it most recently in Orlando to 1,000 teachers that Disney World actually gathered into their convention center as sort of a corporate support of local public schools. And I always, when I go into those situations, I talk about the power of being an asset-building teacher. I show teachers the list of the 40 assets, the way in which a teacher has extraordinary power to be a connector to build these assets. Then I talk about the science that asset-rich kids are so many more times likely to succeed in the academic enterprise than kids who are asset depleted. But while I'm doing those presentations, it's not uncommon for a teacher to begin to cry. And this will happen in either small workshops or big lecture halls. And when you get inside the story of why this teacher is weeping, it's something that goes like this. The 40 developmental assets remind me of why I became a teacher in the first place. That is, they give me a language for the missional side of being a public school teacher. I wanted to be a connector. I wanted to be an adult that mattered. Yeah, I wanted to teach great English literature, but I really wanted to be a person that mattered in kids' lives. The weeping, in part, is about the recall of the mission and the number of years in which they've been working where that mission hasn't had a chance to really rise up, grab hold, and be center stage. That kind of teaching isn't affirmed in human resource policies in schools. It's all about test scores. And so there is this hunger by teachers to recapture the sense of permission, if you will, to be a connector and a relator to kids as part of what it means to be a good teacher. And I can't wait for the day when public schools will have a chance to remember that you got to first establish relationship as a core operating principle of schools before you can be an effective school in the academic enterprise. And I do know now there are 1,000 public schools using our work on developmental assets and asset-building schools, and it's growing really quite rapidly as more and more schools realize unless you have the developmental touch, it is very hard to have the academic touch.
We have just about 10 minutes left. We have several callers. We'll try to get in as many as we can. Our guest is Peter Benson. He's president and CEO of Search Institute. It's a Minneapolis-based nonprofit that's interested in doing research on kids, doing some advocacy, doing some training and instruction all around this basic issue of what it is we do to raise caring and responsible children and adolescents. And our number here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Champagne is the next caller, line 3. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I run a small outreach after-school program for the University of Illinois at an elementary school in Champaign, and in our current reincarnation, we are an after-school daycare with an academic emphasis, and that phase started in 1999, at which point we began to use 13 of the developmental assets from the Search Institute. And we just in the past 2 years have been developing an assessment tool that uses those developmental assets. And we get scores from teachers, the classroom teacher, one of our staff, one of us, the two senior staff, one social worker, one certified teacher, and also from one of the parents, beginning, middle, and end of the school year.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, I thought you might like to hear that.
I love hearing that story. How did you choose the 13 of the 40 assets to focus on?
I wasn't really involved in that part, so I'm not sure. But it's things like comes to school on time, solves problems nonviolently.
Yes, sure. Yeah.
And then we have a 20-point system that we began using last year. At the end of the day, each child is gets a 20-point score with three possible bonus points. It's a very cheap motivator.
Yeah.
And we based it also on these. It's respond positively to school environment, solve school rules,
right.
Be actively engaged in learning, complete homework, et cetera.
Right.
I'm sure you know them.
I do. And those are good choices. But what I really like about the story you're telling is the way a community of adults will that are leading, in this case, an after-school program, and in some sense develop together a vision for what it is we're actually trying to do. And when that vision includes that we want to be a place that builds and promotes developmental assets, it gives, because I've seen this in so many places, a new energy to the climate and culture of an organization to know what it is we're trying to promote in young people's lives. And it comes at a time when so many programs are organized about what problems are we trying to prevent. And across time, that becomes a very hard energy to sustain when you're organized around trying to put out big fires.
Right.
So there is something that is really significant that happens when the organization of a program is around the building of strength. And in some sense, that's what this developmental asset work is all about.
Yeah, the problem we find, we have one family who has had a total of 4 children with us at one time or another, and that the first child came when we started as a after-school daycare in 99, and the youngest child is in 4th grade now and maybe with us through next year. if we survive. The trouble is it's very hard to get funding for something that does something for 20 kids over 5 years. And we have a 1-to-4 or better adult-child ratio. And we have a lot of volunteers in the past. We have paid staff, but we also have volunteers, and they make up probably about a third of our workforce in terms of time. Could I give our website?
Sure.
Okay, it's University of Illinois. It's www.life.uiuc.edu/Hughes for Howard Hughes, H-U-G-H-E-S, / Boast, B-O-A-S-T, like brag.
And may the money roll in.
Yeah, thank you.
But thank you for that powerful story, and may this society become a place that finds programs like yours and makes funding easy rather than taking up half of people's time to chase the next dollar. So we'll know that this society cares more about its kids when great developmental places find support to be easy rather than hard.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We're trying to get at least one more. This next caller is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, listening to you put to mind a book that came out a couple years ago entitled Black American Students in an Affluent Suburb, A Study of Academic Disengagement by Ogbu. You probably know it. And I was kind of curious if you had some sort of comment about that, his kind of take on all this through the filter that you've developed. But if you don't want to go there, I'd at least like to know if these developmental points relate at any in any way to the how affluent in any way to just how affluent a neighborhood is.
Yeah, sure.
That kind of thing, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
A couple of quick points about that is I do not know. I haven't read that book. When you say have you, we academics, we always say we've seen that book. We say that because we never really read anything. So yeah, I've seen your book. I've seen the spinal cover. You know the words on it, but I haven't actually read it, so I don't know how to speak actually to his point. So let me just quickly pick up on a couple other things that are related. Because we have done these developmental asset profiles in so many cities and in so many regions of cities, we do know quite a bit about how it all ties to economics, to poverty and affluence. Here's one quick way of thinking about it. Young people who are in extraordinarily poor neighborhoods with families generating or receiving very little income, average about 16 of these 40 developmental assets. Kids in the most affluent suburbs in the United States might average about 5 assets more, around 21 or so. I suppose that's nice developmentally, the difference between 16 and 21, but even 21 is a far distance from what it means to be an asset-rich young person. So the issue actually in America is that these developmental building blocks are far too fragile for almost all young people. That is, the storyline in America is that most young people are growing up with too little adult support and relationship, too little consistency in the voice of community about what is in bounds and out of bounds, too little engagement in things that empower young people to contribute and make things better. This is the storyline that is occurring absolutely everywhere. And the long-run take on this is, what does it mean to a society to raise a majority of its young people in a way in which they are asset depleted? How well will they parent? How well will they be engaged as citizens? What kind of workers will they become? So I think there are huge long-term societal implications to the way in which we no longer pay attention on a daily basis to the youngest in our midst.
We are going to have to stop. I have a caller. I cannot take my apologies. If you're interested in finding out more about the Search Institute and you have internet access, you can go to their website, which is www.search-institute.org. That's the organization of which Peter Benson, our guest, is president and CEO. And if you'd like to take a look at this, these developmental assets and this idea, this kind of structure for evaluating your community, you can look for his book, All Kids Are Our Kids, and it's published by Jossie Bass, and I'm sure that you should be able to find it in a bookstore or in the library. And then soon there will be an updated, and updated edition, whenever you can manage to find the time to do that.
That's right.
To do that.
That's right.
Thank you very much.
I was delighted to do this. Thank you so much for asking me to be here.
And also we want to say thanks to the folks here at the University of Illinois from the Pampered Chef Family Resiliency Program. Peter Benson is here to give their fall lecture. If you'd like to find out about that program, which is housed within the College of Ag, Consumer, and Environmental Science, you can look at their website, which is www.familyresiliency.uiuc.edu. This program, Focus 580, made possible in part by the Center for Advanced Study at University of Illinois, providing a forum for scholars to discuss issues of importance in both the academic world and the real world through programs like the MillerCom Lecture Series. For more information, go to their website, which is www.cas.uiuc.edu. The broadcast also made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign. Locally owned and operated, serving families since 1925, Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. We're going to break for news and update on the markets. We'll be back, so stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carl Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets. We begin on the outside. January crude oil at $58.95, up 48 cents. Silver for December at $8.51 is up a penny, while gold for December is at $504.50. It's up $2 today. Trade at the Chicago Board of Trade is mixed today. Will they take signals from these outside markets as heading into the close? That waits to be seen. Let's go ahead and look at the update from the board. December wheat at 305 and three quarters, up a quarter. March at 321 and a half is down a half. Over at Kansas City, wheat for December at 366 and a half is down four and a quarter.